Back in 1804, Thomas Jefferson ordered two King James Bibles to be sent to the White House. But he didn't buy these Bibles in order to do his morning devotions or to read scripture. Instead, over the course of a couple of evenings, he took a razor and cut out from the Gospels every story of Jesus working a miracle, anything that was supernatural, virgin birth, the resurrection. He cut it all out of the Bible, and what was left was about one out of every 10 verses, and he pasted those in, made his own little booklet, and he called it The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth. And what Jefferson did was he remade Jesus not as the Son of God, but as a wandering philosopher in Galilee who went about the countryside speaking in parables and offering people proverbs. And over the course of history, folks have regularly remade Jesus. We take the real Jesus and we repackage him to fit our culture. Tom Wright, one of the great New Testament scholars alive today, wrote this. Every month or two, some publisher comes up with a blockbuster saying that Jesus was a New Age guru, an Egyptian Freemason, or a hippie revolutionary. Every year or two, some scholar or group of scholars comes up with a new book full of imposing footnotes to tell us that Jesus was a peasant cynic, a wandering wordsmith, or the preacher of liberal values. The day I was redrafting this for publication, a newspaper article appeared about a new controversy initiated by animal rights activists as to whether Jesus was a vegetarian. And it would not be America unless Jesus was co-opted by corporate America and turned into a big businessman. You know, a century before Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s words were used for the Dodge Ram commercial, which, by the way, how many of you saw that commercial, the Dodge Ram commercial, during the Super Bowl? If you didn't, it was mind-blowing. They took Dr. King's sermon, which was actually a really anti-capitalist sermon, and they pulled out little parts, and then they used it to sell Dodge Rams. Anyway, a century before that, there was a marketing executive who repackaged Jesus. The marketing executive was named Bruce Barton, and he wrote a best-selling book, was a huge bestseller in the 1920s, called The Man Nobody Knows, and he said that Jesus was the greatest advertising executive who ever lived, and that he was the founder of big business. And now, listen, Americans aren't the first group of people, we're not the only group of people who have reshaped and remade Jesus. Over the centuries, virtually everyone has tried to push Jesus into their own culture according to their own preferences, their own tastes. And so in the Middle Ages, Jesus was portrayed as a knight, literally a knight in shining armor, riding a war horse into battle against an evil king named Satan. And these days, there are folk who say that Jesus was a closeted Buddhist. During the so-called missing years, you know, in the Bible, there is a gap in the story of Jesus from the age of 12 to the age of 30. We don't know, what was going on in his life. They're called the missing years. And some Buddhists claim that Jesus traveled to Kashmir, India, where he learned about Buddhism and then took that back. There are Englishmen who claim that during those missing years, Jesus traveled to England. And they wrote this really stupid hymn about that. I mean, you read it and it's about, you know, did his feet wander over these hills? The answer is no. No, no, Jesus was never in England, but Mormons teach that after his resurrection, Jesus came to America, and on top of all of these attempts to reshape Jesus as a vegan, as a, you know, a corporate executive, as an animal rights activist, folks have also tried to even reshape the way Jesus looked. Megyn Kelly from Fox News just a few years ago said this: "Just because it makes you uncomfortable doesn't mean it has to change. Jesus was a white man." I remember the first time Marlene took me to her church. She was going to this little church, and you know, I had never been to church, so she took me to church, and they had a fellowship hall down in the basement. And so they had this big picture on the wall, and I said to Marlene, "Who's that?" And she goes, "Who's that? That's Jesus." And I said, "That's not Jesus. He doesn't look Jewish." I mean, this guy looks like he should be wearing, you know, little wooden shoes and standing by a windmill with some tulips in his hands. It's not Jesus. But it's not just the Dutch who have remade Jesus. And by the way, some of you may have that picture, and please, it's a wonderful painting. So you keep telling yourself that that's what Jesus looked like. And keep that up over your fireplace. Don't write to me about it. It's a great, great painting. But you know, Koreans have remade Jesus into a Korean Jesus. And Africans have remade Jesus into an African Jesus. It is almost certainly the case that Jesus would not have been blonde. He would not have been blue-eyed. He would not have been fair-skinned. The best biblical scholarship about what Jesus may have looked like, let me read to you an account of this. If Jesus was a normal first century Galilean Jew, overall, we can arrive at a general image of Jesus as an average man. He was probably about 5'5" tall. Isn't that great? I mean, you know, I'm 5'7". I know I look much taller. But you know, he'd be like right here. Somewhat slim, reasonably muscular, with olive brown skin, dark brown to black hair, brown eyes. He was likely bearded, but not heavily, or with a long beard, with shortish hair, probably not well kept, and at age 30 at the start of his mission. His precise facial features will nevertheless remain unknown. Now, given the probable description of Jesus, if he showed up at airport security today, he would be given extra screening, right? Because he looked Middle Eastern. Have you ever wondered what the real Jesus looked like? Have you ever wondered why there's not any description of Jesus in the New Testament? None. Nothing about his skin tone, nothing about whether he had a beard, nothing about his hair length, nothing about his height. Why is that? And not only is there no description, not a word, not a line about that in the New Testament, but there's no portrait of Jesus or attempt to draw him or paint him for several centuries after his death and resurrection. Why in the providence of God is there such a silence about the way Jesus actually looked? Well, there was a wise Presbyterian minister back in the 1880s, and here's what he said to his congregation. He said, if he were particularized or localized, if, for example, he was made a man with a pale face, then the man of the ebony face would feel that there was a greater distance between Christ and him than between Christ and his white brother. Instead, because the Bible refused to describe Jesus in terms of racial features, the gospel could appeal to all. Only in this way could the church be a place where the Caucasian and Asian and African sit together at the Lord's table and we all think alike of Jesus and we all feel that he is alike our brother. Very wise. But you know, not only has the real Jesus been remade according to people's cultural preferences, according to their own particular biases, but these days there's a real ignorance about the real Jesus. It's a profound ignorance. I was reading a story from a professor of world religions. He was on a plane flying from Chicago back to Minneapolis, and his seatmate asked him what he did, and his seatmate was a graduate of Dartmouth College, you know, one of America's great colleges, Ivy League school. She was an executive out in California, and she asked him, what do you do? And he said, well, I'm a professor of world religions at this particular university, and he began to complain about the just sheer ignorance of his undergraduate students regarding almost any fact of religion. And he said, you know, for example, most of my undergraduates cannot place Jesus and the Apostle Paul in proper chronological sequence. And this woman said, who is this that you're talking about, the Apostle Paul? And he thought she was making a witty, you know, statement, and he was going to come back with a joke. And then he realized she's serious. Ivy League grad, you know, top executive, had never heard of the Apostle Paul. And maybe some of you are in that situation, but among Americans these days, there is just a profound ignorance of regarding most events and people in the Bible, and that's why millions and millions of Americans bought books like The Da Vinci Code, and millions of folks around the world believe Dan Brown's account that Jesus got married to Mary Magdalene, and they had a child together, and all of that. There are upteen number of websites devoted to the idea that Jesus was a space alien. And he came from another planet to bring to Earthlings this truth that we needed. There are so many different interpretations of Jesus. All you need to do is just, you know, type in to Google, you know, in Jesus, various images, and you'll be overwhelmed. There's so many different interpretations and different stories. Do we have any hope at all of discovering the real Jesus? The real Jesus. And over the next 7 weeks, that's what I hope to do together as a church, to peel back the layers and ask ourselves, you know, underneath all of this sort of cultural layering and all of that, who is the real Jesus? And today I want to begin by talking about the Jesus of history. 92% of Americans say that they believe that Jesus of Nazareth actually existed. The vast, vast majority of Americans believe that Jesus was a real person in history. And it dips slightly among millennials, but even among millennials, 87% of millennials say they believe that Jesus was a real person. Now, that's not true in Europe. And even in a country like England with its, you know, incredible church history, 40% of the English say that they're not sure that Jesus was a real person in history. And the new atheists, people like Richard Dawkins and folks like that, forever write and say that, you know, Christianity is just built on a total myth. And Jesus never actually existed. There's no such person named Jesus. So how do we know that when we're talking about the real Jesus, that he was a person in history, that he actually existed? And is there any evidence for the existence of Jesus? Well, you know, one thing that you need to know is that Jesus, we don't have just records of Jesus in the Bible, we read about Jesus from historians outside of the Bible. There are records of Jesus outside of the Bible from both Roman historians and Jewish historians from which we can reconstruct the outline of Jesus's life. There were Roman historians like Tacitus and Pliny, and Jewish historians like Josephus and Rabbi Eliezer, who wrote about Jesus. Now, I'm not going to give you much detail regarding what these folks said in order to hear about what they said. You're going to have to join a real Jesus small group. Lots of people don't know that outside of the Bible and outside of Jesus's followers, there are records of Jesus. And from these records, we can reconstruct a basic biographical outline of his life. And here's what we would learn from records outside of the Bible: that he existed as a man, that he was called Christos in Greek, which is a translation of the Hebrew Messiah or Mashiach, that he was Mary's son, that he had a brother named James, that he did miracles. Some ancient sources consider him to be a magician or a sorcerer, that he won over both Jews and Greeks as followers. Jewish leaders of the day expressed unfavorable opinions about him. Pontius Pilate rendered the decision that he should be executed. His execution was by crucifixion. He was executed during Pontius Pilate's governorship over Judea. Now, this is from sources all outside the Bible, but it tracks really closely, doesn't it? Exactly what we read in Scripture. You would, if you were to distill down the Gospels, you'd say, well, here's the basic outline, and it's the same thing. Now, if somebody comes to you and they say, look, you know, I've been reading the New Atheists, and they say Jesus never existed, and man, you go on the internet and you can find a counter argument to every single argument. How do I know that Jesus actually existed? How do I know that? How would you respond? You could say to a person who doubts Jesus' existence, that he actually was a real person, you could say to him, listen, the ancient world in which Christianity emerged was anything but a tolerant and inclusive world. And we read lots of early criticisms of Christianity and of Jesus in particular from early critics, the Romans, Jews. Lots of people criticized Christianity, and they said some really harsh things about Christians and about Jesus. But in all of the ancient critiques of Christianity, we don't read one sentence, one line, one word from any critic who ever said, hey guys, this whole thing is a gigantic fraud and Jesus never existed. Now, the most obvious line of attack, if Jesus didn't exist, was to say, wait a minute, what are we talking about? We're talking about a myth, a legend, but we don't read any of that. I think this is one of the strongest arguments for the existence of Jesus. No one in the ancient world ever questioned it at any time. They criticized him, but they never said he didn't exist. And we can consider evidence for Jesus not only outside the Bible, but in the Bible. And I want to consider with you the witness of Luke. And here's what we read in Luke chapter 1. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. Now, from earliest times, this gospel was called the Gospel according to Luke. And who was Luke? Luke was a traveling companion of the Apostle Paul during Paul's third missionary journey. And Luke says this in Luke 1, verse 1. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. He tells us that his was not the first biographical account. There were others. Many people think that he's referring to, at least in part, the Gospel of Mark, which was written before the Gospel of Luke. And he says that he's not an eyewitness. Rather that, and we'll talk about eyewitnesses in just a moment, but he says that rather he carefully investigated eyewitness accounts and compiled them. And here's what we read in verse 3. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus. Now, how did he interview eyewitnesses? How did Luke, you know, talk to these eyewitnesses and write it up like a good newspaper reporter or like a good historian? Well, the book of Acts, which Luke also wrote, he wrote two books in the New Testament, the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts. The book of Acts tells us that Luke was in Jerusalem during the time that the Apostle Paul was in prison. And so historians have fixed that. Between AD 56 and AD 59, Luke was in Jerusalem for 2 to 3 years. During that time, he had the opportunity to inquire about the Jesus story, to set it down, to interview eyewitnesses and write it all up. And he says it was an orderly account. In verse 3, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus. He organized his material in a logical, clear way so that we would know the certainty. This Theophilus, who was probably new in the church or maybe a seeker and wondered, how should I evaluate this Jesus story? He said, let me present you the Jesus story in an orderly way, in a logical way, so that you would know for certain this is true. It's not made up. Now, why should we accept Luke's account? I mean, how do we know that he was a careful investigator and did his work well, that, you know, it's reliable? There was a guy that lived back in the 19th century, early 20th century, who was a world-famous archaeologist and skeptic of the Bible. His name was Sir William Ramsay. Ramsay taught at the University of Edinburgh, and he believed, along with lots of people in that age, that the Bible was basically full of made-up stories, and that the gospel writers, you know, just made stuff up in order to serve their purposes. And Ramsay, as an archaeologist, decided that he was going to take on Luke and prove that Luke was a sloppy historian and that his basic account could not have been true. So Ramsay traveled to Asia Minor, you know, a country we call Turkey today, where much of the book of Acts takes place. And he knew that he couldn't prove or disprove whether the miracles in the book of Acts actually happened. You know, there's no evidence for that. But he would investigate all of the political terms and all of the historic facts and the geographic facts, and he would show that Luke was a sloppy historian. And as he dug in and went to the various places that Luke describes, he found inscriptions that continually backed up Luke's account. And indeed, some political terms that were unknown at the beginning of the 20th century that Luke used, that people said, well, Luke didn't know what he was talking about. We have no evidence that these terms were used. Ramsay actually found inscriptions. He went back to England, this skeptic, as a believer. Now, listen, he even retraced the sea voyage of the Apostle Paul, in which Paul was shipwrecked, and he discovered that the winds were exactly as Luke described. They ended up in the same places, and all of that, at the end of all of these investigations, Ramsey said that Luke was absolutely trustworthy, completely reliable in all of his details. We can trust the gospel accounts. They're not just long, long ago in a faraway place. They're written by people who were either themselves eyewitnesses or interviewed eyewitnesses. So, let's look at verse 2. I want to talk to you about the witness of eyewitnesses. Verse 2. Luke says, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, he based his gospel on eyewitnesses. In the first century, eyewitnesses were what we would know today as eyewitnesses. They were people who were present at an event, who saw and heard what was going on in that event. And you know that Jesus chose 12 apostles, and the reason largely why he chose 12 apostles was for them to be eyewitnesses of everything that Jesus said and did. Now, one of the apostles, one of the 12, betrayed Jesus. His name was Judas Iscariot. He ended up committing suicide. And so the apostles decided to fill out their number and replace Judas. Now, what was the criteria by which they selected the new apostle to make up the 12 again? What were the qualifications to be an apostle? Here's what Peter writes in the book of Acts. Therefore, it is necessary to choose one of the men who have been with us the whole time the Lord Jesus was living among us, beginning from John's baptism to the time when Jesus was taken up from us. For one of these must become a witness with us of his resurrection. And so Peter says there are two qualifications in order to be an apostle. First of all, the person must have been in the company of Jesus, the physical company of Jesus, the whole time of Jesus' ministry. From the beginning, when Jesus was baptized, all the way through until he was ascended. He had to be physically in the company of Jesus so he could testify regarding what Jesus said and what he did. And here's the second qualification. He had to personally witness the resurrection of Jesus. He had to see Jesus actually physically resurrected from the dead, and those were the two qualifications. And you know, in the book of Acts, the apostles regularly say this about themselves. They say, we are witnesses, we're eyewitnesses. We didn't make this stuff up. So Peter writes in Acts 2:32, God has raised this Jesus to life and we are all witnesses of it. Acts 3:15, you killed the author of life, but God raised him from the dead, and we are witnesses of this. Acts 10:40, but God raised him from the dead on the third day and caused him to be seen. He was not seen by all the people, but by witnesses whom God had already chosen by us who ate and drank with him after he rose from the dead. The Gospels were not written 1,000 miles away by people who were just sitting, you know, making up fiction. They were written by eyewitnesses. Matthew was an eyewitness. John says twice in his gospel that I was a witness of these things. And the other two gospels, Mark and Luke, were based upon eyewitness accounts. Now, I want to just offer you one eyewitness account. In a sermon, I can only make a few brief remarks regarding eyewitnesses. If you're somebody who says, gosh, I always have wondered about, you know, is the New Testament really reliable? I mean, gosh, there's so many debates. You can watch the History Channel and Discovery Channel and the internet, and every argument has a counter argument. How do I know that this stuff is really true? The best book on the reliability of the New Testament that I've ever read is called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, by one of the great New Testament scholars alive today named Richard Baucom. Now, it is a big book. And, you know, it's challenging reading. And if you go, you know, that probably is too much for me, I would prefer a little book instead of a big book. Do you have a little book with less pages and less words? Yes. There's a great book called Is the New Testament History by Paul Barnett, and we have those in the bookstore. But let me just offer you one eyewitness so that we would know that the real Jesus really was who the New Testament said he was, and he really did what the New Testament said he did, this Jesus of history. It's based on eyewitness accounts. Here's what we read in Luke. He, that is Jesus, asked them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you only a visitor to Jerusalem and do not know the things that have happened there in these days?" "What things?" he asked. "About Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hope that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it is the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but didn't find his body. They came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive." Now, what Baucom points out in his book and in tremendous detail is that at the time the Gospels were written, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, some of the people mentioned in the gospel stories were still alive, and they were present in the early church in Jerusalem. And so they were guarantors of the truth that we read in the gospels. People could go up to them and say, "Look, here's what it says about you in the gospel. Did this actually happen?" They could go to people in the early church and ask them. So, for example, we read about this guy named Cleopas in this post-resurrection appearance of Jesus in Luke 24. We read about Cleopas. Who is Cleopas? Well, he's almost certainly the same person as John, the gospel writer John, calls Clopas. He was the husband of a woman named Mary, and he was in the company of those who stood by the cross when Jesus was crucified. Here's what we read in John 19, verse 25. Near the cross of Jesus stood his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. Now, the name Clopas, it was a very, very rare Hebrew name, and Cleopas was its Greek, the Greek version of the Hebrew Clopas. And because of such a rare name, it's almost certainly the case that this Cleopas is the same person that is referred to by a very early church historian as being the brother of Jesus' father, Joseph. Cleopas was Jesus' uncle. And when he met Jesus on the road to Emmaus, this was his uncle meeting him. Now listen, this Cleopas had a son named Simon, according to the early church. And this Simon became the bishop of the church in Jerusalem after Jesus' brother James was martyred. And so the point of all of this is to say that when the gospel was written, people could have gone up to Cleopas and asked him, "Did you really see the risen Jesus? Did you really see him on the road to Emmaus?" And in a later generation, they could have gone to his son, Simon, and said, "Simon, did your dad really see the risen Jesus? Is that what he told you?" And Simon could have said, "From the time I was a little boy, Dad had stories about how he saw Jesus on the road to Emmaus." Now listen. Listen up. You know, even if you believe that Jesus was an actual person in history, and all of that I've talked to you about is based upon eyewitness testimony and good evidence, and it's really, really true, like a lot of historical figures, you could say, "Well, so what? You know, that's 2,000 years ago. So what? I've talked with you about the witness to Jesus outside the Bible, the witness to Jesus in the Bible, the eyewitnesses. And you could still say, so what? I mean, look, I could take you to Kentucky, to the place that was, you know, where Abe Lincoln was born. I could prove to you that Lincoln grew up in Kentucky and then he moved to Illinois, and there's an abundance of evidence regarding Lincoln living in Springfield, Illinois. And at the end of that, you go, okay, so, all right, you've proven it. So what? It doesn't affect my life at all. Because Jesus didn't stay dead, because he rose from the dead and is alive today, there is another witness that I want to talk about as we close, and that is the witness of changed lives today. This same Jesus who lived 2,000 years ago is still changing people today.